Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture podcast. Today I've found a really rare kind of guest. It's an academic who does all sorts of botanizing fieldwork, getting out into nature, investigating the diversity of wild species that's all around his area. And he has a particular interest in edible plants, edible fungi, and hints of the history of how Indigenous people have manipulated populations of useful organisms in the past. So it's going to be a cracker of an episode. Dr. Tommy Stoughton, tell us a bit more about yourself and like, how did you get into this particular interest?
Yeah. So, not to go into too much detail, but I'm originally from Southern California, and so there's not a lot of nature right around me, being from LA, but we had these beautiful mountains, and my dad really loved to take us fishing and take us into the mountains, and kind of always experiencing that like 1 or 2 months when things are really green in the spring, and kind of got me interested in sort of environmental science. I originally thought I was going to do something along the lines of like marine ecology or marine biology or something like that when I moved towards college. But then I discovered that scuba diving is actually kind of dangerous. And I met a professor who was an ethnobotanist and took a class with him that basically he had us smelling, eating, tasting like virtually everything that we could. And I just had this epiphany like, oh, I can eat wild things. This is kind of neat. I can use, I can make my own fishing net. I can, go out and potentially, when the apocalypse happens, I'll survive for maybe 2 or 3 days longer than everyone else. And then I'll dehydrate. Kind of inspired by a particular professor in college. Worked for the Forest Service for a couple of years. Kind of a simple job where I could turn off my brain at 5 o'clock and things were good. Working as a rare plants survey technician, and so essentially what happened, I was working in Southern California in the mountains outside of Big Bear, and we were doing monitoring for an endangered plant. It's a Ficeria, it's a rare mustard. And while we were there, we were basically up in the mountains in spring, virtually before anything is really blooming, trying to see if these plants were up yet, because mustards bloom pretty early in the spring. And we discovered the last bloom of this spring beauty. It was a genus Claytonia, and it was a perennial species, and I didn't recognize it at the time. And I started doing some sleuthing, and it turned out to be a species that was not known from the mountain range, but had been previously described many, many years ago in the early 1900s by some botanists from the San Gabriel Mountains, which are, stone's throw on the other side of the San Andreas Fault. And essentially, I started looking pictures of that thing, and the plants that I had discovered looked similar, but pretty different from those. And then I did some more sleuthing, and I found that not only did the plants that I found look different from those, but the two populations looked really different from what they were being called, which was this widespread species that occurred basically from British Columbia down to near Mexico. And it was no varieties treated or anything like that. And just kind of started asking some questions about like, how could someone make this mistake? Is this a mistake? And decided to go to grad school and started kind of doing some lab work. I never really was a lab rat. I was really always a field botanist. I had a sort of a knack for regurgitating Latin epithets and really noticing differences here and there, and definitely identify as a sort of splitter in the dichotomy of lumpers and splitters in taxonomy. It's like, Every population to me is like, there's something different about this. Let's investigate it. So, just kind of found a passion for utilizing my what I think is like a pretty decent attention to detail with some newfound knowledge about how to understand the genetic underpinnings, the evolutionary histories of plants, with kind of picking mushrooms always kind of in my back pocket for many, many years. So
Do
yeah,
you
it was really inspiration from a professor that just snowballed.
think we're living in a golden age of amateur botanical fieldwork? That there's a whole bunch of tools that have made it possible, if they want to get interested in this, that you can get out into all sorts of pockets of nature and find things and identify things and, talk to other people about what you've found in a way that wasn't
Yes,
possible a generation ago.
I do. Back in the day, people were really utilizing literature and descriptions, textual descriptions, maybe some illustrations, things like that. Nowadays, you can find a picture of almost anything. I mean, there's platforms like iNaturalist, which are amazing, utilizing artificial intelligence to help you to identify something, sometimes with a little too much precision and not so much accuracy, but most of the time, both of those couple together, and then alongside numerous experts in various groups who are always, surfing the web and trying to help folks to better identify these plants, myself included. And so that we can use these data. I mean, right now I'm actually working on a project that uses iNaturalist data, and I have curated something like 25,000 Claytonia observations for like 30 taxa or something like that. And we're doing niche modeling. And it just wouldn't, I wouldn't be able to do that with herbarium specimens, but with pictures, it's so easy for me to really quickly scan an image, check that, the data is good in terms of locality, date, things like that, and just add it to my data set pretty quick. So, yeah, there's some amazing tools right now that really are so inviting for anyone that's interested in learning about the natural world right now that just didn't exist, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It's really incredible.
I think a really good example of this is the Crime Pays But Botany Doesn't YouTube channel.
Sure.
Joey Santore has been flying all over the world, going to the most amazing habitats and just looking at what's around. It's Oh, I had another question. So, I was lucky enough during my uni time to do field work all over Australia, looking for a particular genus to analyze chemicals, blah blah blah. But as I did more of that, I reached the point where I could just look out the window at the landscape and be like, yes, that genus is here, or it's not. Like, I developed this weird instinct and I couldn't describe what I was looking for. Have you found a similar thing, like, through all of your extensive work? Like, you just go to a new place, look around, and there's something about the feel of it that tells you what kind of plant communities will be hiding around the corner.
Yeah, so kind of I do that with a variety of things. So definitely when I was doing my graduate work, and I had a real narrow focus on spring beauties and to a lesser extent the genus Bokera, which is a mustard that is wild. We could talk about that. It's really interesting, but I kind of always had a sense I could be driving. And we knew that, maybe there was a historic collection of spring beauties somewhere in this mountain range. And so we just head out into the road, and all of a sudden, you just out of the corner of your eye, you see this talus slope with a melting, snowpack patch above it. And you're like, there's spring beauties right up there. Let's go. And you go up there and you get it, 9 times out of 10. So we found. We found spring beauties in mountain ranges they'd never been found before, or extended species ranges considerably by doing just that, especially in Nevada, where All these mountain ranges are separated by many, many miles, and depending on how the rainfall comes, you might have, a month separation in terms of the phenology for this mountain range versus this one over here. And so it can be a real wild goose chase to find spring beauties, which are above ground for, anything from 14 to maybe 28 days, depending on the conditions. And that's going through first emergence all the way to flowering, fruiting, and disappearing, because they're succulent and they basically just get obliterated, wither away, and are back underground before much of anything else is blooming. The other thing that I'm like kind of constantly doing with mushrooms around here in the Northeast is always kind of looking at the habitat and being able to say, okay, I'm pretty sure there's porcini here, or I'm pretty sure there's matsutake or morels or chanterelles, which really in New Hampshire they're everywhere because our soils are so acidic. But yeah, definitely with mushrooms, it's all about timing, much like it was with spring beauties. So you can really have an advantage if you can recognize kind of the trends in habitats and landforms and things like that. And then just kind of try and hone in on the correct timing, which can really be facilitated by a lot of local identification groups on Facebook and other social media platforms. I mean, I manage a couple different groups, and essentially, if 9 out of the last 10 posts are people with a picture of a porcini, I'm like, okay, I need to go check my porcini spots, or go to that spot I think has porcini, but I've never looked at the right time, stuff like that. So yeah, kind of always surveying the land and deciding whether or not it'd be worth to come back and when.
Do you suspect AI coupled with satellite images could potentially be really useful for finding like new little pockets of habitat for certain genera that you're looking for?
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, it depends on the resolution of the images, but certainly, there's certain plants that require certain canopy, levels in terms of density, things like that, broadwood or broadleaf forest versus conifer forest, things like that. There's a lot of information that I can glean by looking at Google images and things like that, that almost certainly an AI or a computer can do better than me, with like the asterisk that sometimes an AI can fail like epically.
Spectacularly,
Yes. But yeah, no, I think we're definitely in the age where, given how much data we can collect on the ground and feed the models, AI is definitely a tool that we can leverage to find especially rare things in new places where they haven't been discovered.
Now, where I first learned about you is through your amazing blog, which particularly focuses on a genus I'm so intrigued with. We don't have it here in Australia, called Claytonia. So do you want to like walk us through this genus and what you've been investigating and discovering about it?
So that's right. So I studied spring beauties, and the blog was basically something that I created during grad school. You might have noticed that I haven't really contributed to it in a couple of years. That might change now that I am finding myself with more free time. My daughter is now 6 years old and going to school, and I'm finding myself on occasion being able to twiddle my thumbs and muse about plants and things like that. But yeah, so I study spring beauties. In this, these days I'm more interested in patterns across the genus. So the genus was described by Linnaeus. There's something like I think there's 32 or 33 species recognized. Basically, Eastern Asia, North America has the bulk of diversity. both Western and Eastern. There's not as many species in Eastern North America. There's a ton of species in Western North America, and there's not many species in Eastern Asia, but I think that it's actually probably pretty poorly studied over there. Just based on what I've been finding with my research in Western North America, primarily in the southern part of the range, and thinking about glacial histories of these mountain ranges and things like that towards the southern extent of glaciation. Yeah, the genus is divided into really three major sections, taxonomic sections that correspond loosely with growth history or life history strategies. So you have a section of primarily annual species, a section Limnia. So miner's lettuce is one of the species that a lot of people know. It's actually in cultivation, used for greens, leafy greens. As well as Claytonia siberica, which is used for greens and also just in cultivation for aesthetic purposes. And so in addition to the annuals, which represent maybe half the diversity, there is another couple of sections that correspond with different parentation structures. So there's a section rhizomatosae, which is rhizomatous and stoloniferous perennials. There was a section Catocosi, which are Catocos perennials, sort of the carrots of the group. And most of the genetic data suggests that Catocosi really is part of section Claytonia, which is the group that I study, which are the tuberous perennials. And so for my dissertation research, I kind of mentioned earlier, I set out to address a particular species called the Western Spring Beauty, Claytonia lanceolata, which occurs from British Columbia down to California, and basically all the way from the coast to Colorado and the Rocky Mountains, and everywhere in between, especially in the mountains, especially as you go further south. Because of the issues associated with field work and really the short season, I found that I had to sort of narrow my focus to diversity in California. And that is in part because I took what was treated as one species and divided it into five species and actually eight taxa. So the stuff in Southern California, I ended up treating as multiple subspecies of a species, Claytonia pearsoni. So Claytonia pearsoni subspecies bernardinus was the one that kind of brought me down the rabbit hole. And what I found is the tuberous species seem to have a propensity for diversifying in edaphic situations. So we have described species that are restricted to limestone, species that are restricted to rhyolite, species that are just restricted to like serpentine or serpentinite. There's your really boring lanceolata, which seems to be on anything that's felsic. But a lot of these sort of specialist species, which, you know, they're interesting because they're rare. Many of them are known from only one or two populations, but within those populations, there's thousands of individuals. So they're subject to, you know, catastrophic loss and therefore worthy of conservation. But it's kind of interesting because their effective population size is actually kind of large, and they're outcrossing and things like that. So I have since moved to the east of North America. So originally from Southern California, now I'm in New Hampshire, kind of the opposite extreme. And the diversity in the east is not quite as interesting necessarily, but that is in part because you know, the species were described. I mean, Claytonia virginica was described by Linnaeus and Carolinianna. The other species in the east are one of three. was described by Michaux in the 1800s. And essentially, there hasn't been anyone really looking at them since then. The chromosomal data suggests that there are maybe five species that we call Virginica, and at least two species that we call Caroliniana. So I've never seen the real deal Caroliniana. I've only seen the undescribed thing that we call Caroliniana in New Hampshire. And I want to deal with it. I want to get a graduate student on it, personally, but I have kind of focused my efforts on the East and more so on the genus as a whole, and trying to extend some of my research related to kind of what some might call like micro species, or these sort of elusive small populations of rare species that have been overlooked. And I think a lot of the problem with species diversity having been overlooked in Claytonia is that they're succulent plants. So they make really awful looking herbarium specimens. I mean, I have tried so hard to make nice specimens, and I think I was awarded the Cooley Award in many years ago at a botany meeting for a best talk by a graduate student. And I think it was because I likened the typical herbarium specimen of a Claytonia to a turd, because that's really what they look like. They don't translate well to two dimensions. And so I was able to use that to justify doing a lot of field work, which is what I wanted to do anyways, and then kind of shoring up my hypotheses with the genetic data and morphological data. So,
And Claytonia seems to be a really good example of this emerging pattern of populations of relatively morphologically similar looking plants that have all sorts of crazy things going on with their chromosome numbers. Did you want to dig into what you were finding on that front?
Well, I didn't necessarily look at chromosome numbers the research prior to, because back in the day, that was kind of the popular thing to do, was to squash buds or root tips and get chromosome counts for plants. Essentially, every species of Claytonia has a polyploid series associated with it. Most of them have euploid series. Some of them have aneuploid series, including Claytonia virginica, which has the longest aneuploid series of any organism on the planet. So,
Can I just
if
quickly
your viewers are
explain?
not,
Can I explain what those terms mean, or do you want to have a go just to translate it for general gardeners out there?
that's exactly what I was going to try and do. So, a euploid duplication is basically a duplication of the entire genome. And this is usually what the strategy associated with domesticating crops is, to hybridize either different chromosome numbers or hybridize different species, and you get these mix-ups in meiosis that result in a chromosomal duplication. So the entire genome is doubled, or quadrupled, or octupled,
And that often
and
leads to larger, kind of bulkier plants that are
it
more
can.
appealing as crops.
Absolutely. And so aneuploidy is different. So aneuploidy is basically like one or two extra chromosomes. It's the equivalent of, Down syndrome in humans. And so what spring beauties seem to do very well is just take on a couple extra chromosomes here and there. And so Claytonia virginica, for example, has something like 2 n equals 12 to 2 n equals 193, and all numbers in between reported. It's really, really wild.
So, what's going on with their cellular division? Particularly sexual cellular division is traditionally very sensitive to having mixed up numbers of chromosomes. How do the
Yes.
do, does anyone know how the Claytonians are just like, we don't care, we'll deal with it.
I Yeah, I really don't know. People ask me that question sometimes, like, well, how are they reproducing? And I'm just like, somehow, they can reproduce asexually. You can split a tuber and potentially get multiple plants. But I think at some point there has to be sexual reproduction, and how they're doing it, it breaks my brain when I think about it. I really don't know.
Do you have any theories about if there's any advantage that's driving this process? And I'll maybe refer to some examples of ferns and mosses that have really high duplications of their chromosomes. They're often in extreme habitats where they have to go between very wet and very dry conditions so they can like turn all of those genes on and off one at a time. Is that possible, something that's happening in Claytonia as well?
I think so. I mean, the idea is essentially if you're doubling your genome, then you're increasing variation within upon which natural selection can act. So in duplicating your genome, once or twice over, then there's the potential that there might be something that is co-opted for a new purpose, or for occupying a new habitat, or being better able to expand your niche, or your sort of plasticity, if you will, to respond to certain environmental conditions. So Claytonia are adapted for disturbance, really. Pretty much all of them occupy habitats that are disturbed, usually on a regular basis, on a regular frequency, and I think that
They're like rock, they're
could well be
like gravel
related.
slides, I think is a
Yeah,
common place.
some on talus slides. I mean, in the east, Caroliniana is basically on colluvium, slopes that are experiencing creep, whereas Virginica, in the southeast at least, is like basically on floodplains. And things like that. So yeah, pretty much all of the species I think are really associated with some kind of disturbance regime that is relatively frequent.
And that makes them like ideal candidates for domestication because like domesticated spaces regularly get, turned upside down.
Sure.
Now, the genus has a long history of use before European colonization in North America. Do you have any thoughts about how far back that goes and how extensive the relationship between humans and Claytonia has been?
Yeah, so I'm not that well versed in sort of the ethnobotanical literature, but there are quite a few pretty well documented occurrences of cultivation of certain species of Claytonia. So out west, there's pretty good documentation that Claytonia lanceolata actually is cultivated and part of a cultural tradition that involves harvest and potentially trade, especially in British Columbia. And in the East, there's pretty good evidence that Claytonia virginica was traded like up and down the Appalachian Trail, and traded by Native Americans well before European contact, which going back to thinking about this really wacky chromosome situation could well be the signature of the trade of what otherwise would be geographically isolated lineages that are then brought back into secondary contact by a trade by native people.
Does the genus hybridize readily, like in nature or in cultivation?
Yes. Yeah. So there's pretty good evidence. So numerous species, especially out west, will overlap in range. So you can find two or three, or I think my record was five species of Claytonia at one site, occupying sort of different land forms, but basically parapatric in basically sympatric in the same general area. And it seems quite clear that where they co-occur, though they do have distinct ranges and in relatively distinct habitats, where they co-occur or where they overlap, you can almost always find hybrids. And it's sort of the bane of my existence when it comes to identifying annual Claytonia. And, ultimately, when I have my way with it, I'll treat those as a separate genus because I don't want to deal with them. They confuse me more often than not, and I just haven't really given them the time of day. But there is pretty strong evidence that multiple spring beauties co-occur in a lot of different places, and where they co-occur, they do hybridize and potentially intergress. And some of my dissertation research and some of the papers that we published after I graduated, we kind of suggested that there might be evidence that supports the idea that some of the species that we were describing are the result of ancient hybridization events.
Oh, you'd need mountains of genomic data to dig into it, but someone will get to it eventually.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, what about the potential in the future for people to work with this genus and domesticate it further? Is there much happening? I know a few species are grown as like specialty greens, but is that like just the tip of the iceberg of what could be done with this genus?
Yeah, I think so. All species of Claytonia are edible above ground and below ground. There's a couple annual species that are cultivated primarily for greens, or for aesthetic purposes. But there is, like I mentioned, there's evidence that the tuberous species, for example, were traded, probably eaten for greens, but probably also the tubers were eaten as well. I mean, there's evidence that the tubers are eaten, at least more recently in cultural Native American practices. And there's some species, like I said, they kind of have this knack for not taking their chromosome seriously, which is like, that's a check mark for potential for cultivation. And there's some of these species, especially out west, that have actually pretty large tubers that theoretically you could make even bigger. They grow right near the surface. They're pretty easy to extract. They grow, in these huge populations that suggest that they can be pretty sort of crowded into a space, so they could be fairly productive use of space theoretically if you can get a handle on the conditions within which to grow them, which I am not a horticulturalist. I couldn't tell you how many research plants I brought home and subsequently killed by overwatering or whatever it was. Like, I do not have a green thumb, but I know a lot of people do, and there are people that are cultivating spring beauties more so for flowers. So I didn't mention there are some spring beauties that actually have yellow flowers that are just these, like, some seem to be a color polymorphism that is, it's not really like an evolutionary unit that is worth recognizing at the species level per se. There's sort of forms that pop up and go away in a population year after year. But there are others that actually do seem to be fixed for yellow flowers or pink flowers or things like that. Plus, they have delicious tubers, so it's kind of more bang for your buck with that. But yeah, I in answer to your question, I do think that there is a lot more that we could do, especially with the perennials. Some of the rhizomatous perennials have pretty thick and fleshy rhizomes that could be pretty interesting to cook with. I always, it was sort of my tradition. So when I was doing field work, the spring beauties bloom next to melting patches of snow and often in the same habitats and at the same time as morels. So I was always cooking up tubers or just eating them raw, cooking up morels, not eating those raw. And then eating the greens and things like that. So I felt like I ate like a king when I was doing field work, even though I was like camping and living on, a grad student kind of dime, if you will. But yeah, I think there's a lot more that one could do, especially for getting some more species into culinary production.
And you only have to look a few centuries back at the ancestor of the carrot when it had basically no useful root on it. And it gives you a hint about how a species can be transformed with consistent attention. So, yeah, I'm putting the vibes out into the universe. Somebody's got to get onto this opportunity. Now, you also do amazing work with edible fungi. So, do you want to tell me about that side of your life?
So I've been picking mushrooms, since I was about 17. And essentially, in Southern California, especially, we have pretty decent diversity, but the window for collecting is very short. There's maybe a couple weeks you can get out of the mountains in the summer, depending on if monsoon comes. And then there's a pretty decent window for collecting delicious edibles in the wintertime, which is when things are green and when we're getting rain. But since I've moved to the Northeast, it's pretty much all the same genera, and in many cases, it's very closely related species. And so the transition to the East, in terms of being able to recognize things that I could put in my mouth, was really easy. And so I started a small business selling foraging wild mushrooms and selling them locally to a couple different restaurants and also to my local farmers market. So yeah, it's kind of always been a passion of mine to be able to go out and collect food, either food plants or mushrooms. And this is just kind of a little side gig. It essentially pays for itself. It doesn't really bring home the big bucks. It's definitely a hobby. It keeps me outside, it keeps me healthy, and I really enjoy picking mushrooms. I was at home with my daughter, actually, raising her, and so I had her on my chest out picking mushrooms, since like she was like 3 or 4 months. So it's been a lot of fun.
What a start to life. Do you have any thoughts on how people, either historically or in the future, could manipulate the landscape to encourage edible, useful mushroom production? Because, like, in your part of the world, you've got such diverse and vibrant forests. Like, there's so many different species of trees and understory plants, all kind of elbowing for opportunities. And yeah, thoughts on that?
So absolutely. We're actually kind of trying to do a little bit of that now. It's sort of a long-term strategy, for sure. So it's not something that you can do, and expect results the next season or something like that. There's some things, where people are actually cultivating morels, for example, nowadays, indoors as well as outdoors, or in semi-controlled outdoor situations. And there's opportunities for sure to create favorable habitats for certain decomposers. As far as trying to create habitats that are suitable for mycorrhizal species, which is considerably more difficult. I think the truffle farmers of the world have demonstrated that it's definitely possible to create an orchard that's suitable for growing those mycorrhizal species. But I think what you're talking about is maybe creating a habitat that supports a diversity of species, which is really what we're shooting for. So right now I live on a 30-acre plot that's entirely wooded, and it's mostly mixed hardwood. We've got a couple patches of mixed conifer forest. So what we're doing is kind of thinning out, or doing an overstory reduction, as the foresters like to call it, but kind of thinning out some of the trees that are not really as productive in terms of mycorrhizal fungi. So I've had a couple foresters come through my woods, and they want to take every hemlock tree, for example, whereas From the perspective of a mycologist, I'm like, well, there's like 100 things that that associate with the hemlock, and so I want to keep every single one of those. I don't care if it's the most valuable wood that I have; it's more valuable to me as a mycorrhizal, associate for some of the things that I really enjoy eating. So yeah, I think there are some manipulations that you can do to the landscape in terms of creating different hydrological situations, as well as favoring certain host species, just like like you would for a sugar bush. If you want to have maples, you clear out the woods and you protect your maple saplings and seedlings, and you grow it from the ground up. I think the same is true for trying to favor certain conifers or certain hardwoods that are associated with the choice edible mushrooms that you desire. So I'm still hopeful that I can get Matsutake growing on my property. I have plenty of hemlock. I have, pretty high water table. Podzol is quite near the surface, but I have yet to see any Matsutake pop up, even though I have cast like a bajillion Matsutake caps and slushes and all kinds of stuff like that in what seems like the right habitat. But, time will tell.
I guess with fungi, I mean, plants are like this as well to some degree, that they you can do a certain amount to favor a particular species, but at the end of the day, they have to want to grow on that particular geology and climate, and like all the little ingredients have to line up. It's not that different to those
Absolutely.
Clatonias where each population has a particular kind of gravel slip that it's specialized in doing well in, and recreating that exact thing is almost impossible. It's a very location specific quality.
Definitely. There's so many parameters, and to think that we know them all, and can so easily recreate what has taken, millions or hundreds of millions of years to hone in on, a specific habitat is really naive.
And I'm fungi in particular, with their ability to spread spores pretty much everywhere, they have that luxury of choice. Like they really have to grow in the spots that they love.
Absolutely. I mean, you would think that if fungi wanted to grow there, if the conditions were favorable, then they would be there.
They'll find their way.
I think there's some data that suggests most spores actually fall pretty close to the mushroom from which they are released, but there's some percentage of spores that travel, infinity distance, and so definitely, I think if you build it, they will come, but it's a matter of building it, that's the hard part for
You've got to
sure.
build it exactly right.
Yes.
Now we should probably, I'm trying to think, are there other points that I haven't asked you about? Because you're such a different kind of guest. I'm sure I've missed something. So is there some aspect of all of the stuff that you're doing that I've kind of glanced off?
I don't know. I mean, one of the things that I've been kind of striving to do is having to do with like with my business, for example, is kind of introducing these gourmet foods and potentially wild foods that a lot of folks, especially in rural New Hampshire, have never experienced. Trying to give them the opportunity to learn their land. So there's this fellow Adam Harriton, maybe you've heard of him, who that's what he's always professing is you've got all this amazing stuff in your backyard, you just don't know it. And so it's one of the things that really makes me excited about teaching, about hosting classes and things like that. And I've got a lot of people who who have an interest in foraging mushrooms, and maybe they don't really know a whole bunch of mushrooms or whatever. It can be overwhelming to try and learn them all, and I don't recommend that anyone try to learn more than, maybe four or five a season, just so that they can get really, really familiar with those. But I'm always telling people, if I'm down at the farmer's market, you should come down and see what I have at my table. You might buy something, you might not, but you can take a look, and I can almost guarantee that if you go out in the woods, you will see what I have in your woods. Because the mushrooms are everywhere. And if there's something that I have an abundance of, it's because there's an abundance in the woods right now. And so I'm always telling people, just come down and see what I have, and you could probably go out and get it yourself.
Do each of the different species of wild mushrooms have distinct harvesting and handling and preparation demands? Like it takes a while to learn the culture associated with each one?
So I mean, aside from, identification, there's certain features that you really need to pay attention to, and they vary from group to group. So my specialty are boletes, for example, which you really need to pay attention to characteristics related to bruising and staining and color changes, as well as smell and host trees and things like that, which is pretty similar for a lot of different fungi. But yeah, as far as like storage and preparation, there's the data that's out there suggests like for harvesting, you can cut it, you can pluck it. It doesn't really matter statistically anyways. But what you do from there, there's a lot of strategies for kind of making it work. So like I always pull a mushroom out of the ground and I clean it up in the field, and the reason is because I'm going to toss this all into a basket. And so if I'm collecting something like Matsutake, which grows in like clay and sand, like I don't want to get a bunch of sand in my basket, like gritty in the gills of all these mushrooms and things like that. So I kind of clean as I go, at least kind of loosely. I have these micro perforated, they're basically like bread bags, which can help to reduce water loss in mushrooms. So, if you're in the business of selling mushrooms and it's always by weight, if these things are respiring, they're losing water, which means they're weighing less and thus less valuable. So you can actually kind of keep certain mushrooms for longer, or at least prevent them from losing so much water so fast with these bread bags. But there's some mushrooms that just absolutely cannot go into these bread bags, or they will just, there's something bad that happens and I can't explain it. So like boletes, for example, they would just want to be in a box, like open air. They do not want to go into one of these little micro perforated bags, but chanterelles just love it. Stuff like that. Yeah, there's tricks of the trade for sure. And I think every mushroom is unique in terms of, flavor and texture and color and taste. And it's just a matter of learning what works for any given mushroom in any given place.
Well, I mean, that probably covers, or at least leads into my standard question of your vision of the future of food in your community. So, I mean, carry on with that idea. Like, how do you see your whole community evolving as like a food ecosystem?
Yeah, so I mean, as I mentioned, there's a lot of wild edible plants and mushrooms in the Northeast, and I'm really a fan of kind of trying to keep it as local as possible. So there's nothing that prevents me from taking a 2 hour drive down to Boston and making two or three times as much selling into a community that can sort of afford it compared with rural New Hampshire. But I'm really much more interested in kind of the teaching and learning aspect of it, and really introducing the local community to things that they just might not really get the opportunity to experience, at least not at this kind of at this kind of level or for this kind of cost. And I really am a strong proponent of keeping it local, and that's kind of what I strive to do is selling to the local restaurants, the local community members, as well as educating them, because I think in terms of sustainability, we would all really behoove ourselves to learn some things about what we can do in our own backyard to sustain what seems like an ever increasing population.
Particularly mushroom foraging seems like a skill that is best taught person to person. Like you can learn some things from books, but there's always a question at the back of your mind: am I completely misinterpreting what I'm supposed to be doing? Because
Sure.
if you really get things wrong, it can be, I don't know. I mean, there are, horror stories of people who pick the wrong mushroom and yada yada yada.
I always recommend to people there are certain groups that you can pick where there are no known lookalikes that will cause death, only severe gastrointestinal distress. So you might wish you were dead, but you won't die if you make a mistake. And that being said, like obviously you need to know what you're going to eat. If you're going to try and identify a mushroom for a table, you need to be 100% sure of what you're doing. And in that sense, really seeking feedback from others is always a good idea. And I would be lying to you if I said that, I went out and started picking mushrooms and didn't have someone who kind of showed me the ropes and helped me get over that initial fear of like, what if I die? Or what if I made a mistake or whatever. At some point I did fledge and I felt capable enough that I could start to identify things utilizing books and things like that and be confident in my identification. But that took a really long time, and I'm still extremely cautious. I mean, for example, I like Amanita cause are reportedly responsible for like 9 out of 10 fatal mushroom poisonings. And while there are a couple Amanita that I eat, there are many, many more edible Amanita that I don't feel comfortable with. I just don't. It's a risk that I don't feel like I necessarily need to take, given how many other delicious edibles there are in my woods. And so I don't really pay too much attention to Amanita other than appreciating the diversity and the aesthetics. Like most of the Amanita are just gorgeous mushrooms, but I can appreciate them from a standing position and move on with my day. But there's a lot of groups like that where there are edibles, but there are also, some potentially catastrophically deadly toxic relatives in the group, and it's a slippery slope.
You might be interested to know, I've accidentally started, I guess you'd say, cultivating a mushroom in my local garden. So I grow a biomass plant, a vetiver grass, that I cut back the tops really hard. So you end up with like dead biomass accumulating at the base of the clumps. And then
Sure.
I find if any of those clumps, I urinate on them, if I pee on them as I'm out in the garden, that becomes an amazing habitat for one of the stinkhorns. Don't know if you know Dictyophora induciata, the one that gets the
Oh
big.
yeah.
I've got them everywhere, and they're growing like 6 inches up in the clump when we
Oh, that's
have
so
wet
cool.
weather. Yeah, I've never seen them growing like almost like an epiphyte.
No, that's so funny. It's always hilarious the things that we do that certain mushrooms respond to favorably.
It'd be nice if it was an edible species, but yeah, this is one that is fly pollinated and very spectacular to look at with its big lacy veil and the wrinkled top on it. But yeah, not the kind of thing you want to eat.
Some of the stinkhorns are edible if you catch them at the early stage before they are reproductive and not so stinky and smelly. I don't know specifically about the veiled stinkhorns, but some of the equally stinky stinkhorns can be eaten.
before they're crawling in
depending.
flies.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, a final question I love asking everyone to wrap up. If you could create or domesticate an organism with like no practical limits, like you've got as many years and as many millions of dollars as you need to pull off the project, what would you love to see kind of created in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of lame in that I would really love, I mean, like something that I'm striving to do right now is I would really love to see Matsutake in cultivation. It's my favorite mushroom, and I mean, I eat a lot of mushrooms, so that is saying something. But it's one of those ones that, you know, it's a mycorrhizal species, and I would love to hone in on exactly the way to be able to create a sort of an economically viable orchard for Matsutake production, for sure.
Do you suspect there's potential for breeding those host tree species to be like more welcoming to the fungus? It might come with a fitness penalty that like those particular strains will need extra care to make sure that they dominate a space.
Yeah. No, I have never really thought about that. You know, like with Matsutake in particular, there are some conditions related to soil characteristics that are kind of the prerequisite. So I had never really thought about whether or not there are certain you know, genotypes of trees that might be more prolific in terms of their forming associations. It's a really excellent question and a fun thought exercise for sure.
I wonder if the people attempting to cultivate truffle orchards have delved into this, if they've looked at comparing different strains of it's
Sure.
usually oaks that they use, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I believe so. And I mean, just kind of thinking off the top of my head, generally speaking, I think it's kind of always going to be advantageous to form more associations. And that's just in part because these are a partnership wherein, you know, the trees are getting access to certain nutrients and more water through the fungi. So in many instances, they're kind of relying on those fungal associates to really thrive. So I think there's kind of always a selection force that is driving them to make more you know, more connections, but it's fun to think about like where the trade-off would be if there is. I mean, there's always, you know, an evolutionary or a fitness trade-off for everything. So where that is, I don't know.
Now, we're kind of going through a golden age for amateur, fungal culture, I'd say, like people with controlled atmosphere rooms and experimenting with different media and inoculation, all that kind of stuff to grow pretty much any mushroom you can imagine. But I look at that and it's got a very high tech barrier to like set up the conditions. Some mushrooms are more adaptable than others, but I don't know how aware you are of that side of the world, but are there promising signs that we're getting better at working with fungi in more controlled conditions that don't require a whole laboratory to pull it off?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason in part that you know, in a lot of cases you need really highly controlled conditions is that there are certain contaminants that can just you know, sort of overwhelm a certain fungus that you're trying to cultivate, and they might not necessarily exist in the natural environment where that fungus grows and thrives, but when you try to bring it into a situation where you're going to cultivate it, it can be introduced. And so I think there are a lot of like really interesting you know, techs out there, and I think we are getting more sophisticated with respect to how to sort of circumvent certain issues related to cultivation. I mean, you know, right now, so I teach 6th through 8th grade math and science, and my science class were our class pet is a kombucha SCOBY, which is fun. But we're also going to start growing oyster mushrooms, and we're actually going to be growing the oyster mushrooms on recycled newspaper kitty litter, and the nitrogen source is durable food. So it's stuff like that where people are coming up with these ideas like, would this work? And experimenting and sharing their knowledge, through all these different social media and internet platforms that, really the golden age of information, I think, is making it such that we can really communicate what is science, is people experimenting and documenting and reporting what works, what doesn't, and yeah, I think there's a suggestion there that we're getting better at doing all of these kind of problem solving techniques to grow more things and to grow kind of have more production, more productive crops with every every waking minute.
The kombucha SCOBY feels like a really interesting platform. Like it's such a huge advance on like if you're doing a yeast or fungal culture in solution and it's just individual cells floating around, that requires much more precision in how you're handling everything compared to the kombucha SCOBY, which is much more accessible for people without that level of skill to get started with a microbial culture. And
Sure.
I wonder if like you could incorporate other fungi into that SCOBY in the future, like have mushrooms growing out the top of it rather than just producing a vinegary drink.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, you would need, depending on the fungus, you would need the food source, so like with the SCOBY, it's feeding on sugar water. So I think you would need a food source in order to grow something else, but it's fun to think about like what else could we do with that for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to think like before kombucha SCOBYs appeared spontaneously, that whole idea of that kind of fleshy microbial mat organism being useful, it had never been seen before. So it was kind of like, how would you even predict it was possible? Oh, well, this has been an amazing, fun conversation. I'm so glad that I got a recommendation and that you said yes to coming into chat. To round things off, where can people learn more about what you do? I'll put links in the show notes for anything you want to point people to.
Oh yeah. So I mean, theoretically, claytonia.org might be revived into some kind of a website for my business, and also a platform for disseminating my research. I do I do a lot of I'll say public outreach or public education through Instagram. It's really like my primary motivation for being on Instagram and Facebook and things like that. So yeah, I can give you the links to Mad Prof Mushies for sure.
Brilliant, brilliant. I recommend people to check all of that out, particularly the photos that you've taken of Claytonia in your field work are just gorgeous. Just to give
Yeah,
people an
well,
idea, if you've
they're pretty
never,
plants.
if you've never delved into that before, it could be like a whole new passion. At this time in history, almost anyone can get into it if you get a little bit of time off and a little bit of opportunity for traveling. All of these kind of things are just on your doorstep to go and explore.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It's very nice meeting you, and I appreciate the invite to be on your podcast.
The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.